Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Thank you, Joshua. I'm Dave Cohen. Back to Tommy Tucker now on WWL.
You know, this streetlight thing is interesting because they say the reason it's going to take so long is because the stuff was underground, and was damaged, right?
Yeah, when they say when the bars moved from the wind, the cross beams, they actually crimped the wires that connect to the changing equipment that controls the lights underground.
But then, when we talk about strengthening the infrastructure, we talk about burying
it underground,
right?
Yes.
So, I don't know. You always want what you don't have?
Yeah, grass is always greener.
I guess, yeah. But
I'll tell you this.
When a storm happens, you know.
In my neighborhood, all of the utilities are buried. And unless the lines leading to my neighborhood on the poles go down, we never lose power in my neighborhood, ever. And it's been fantastic. So,
but did you lose trees, like uprooted and all of that?
Yeah, but all of the electrical and telephone and gas is all in the backyard in the right-of-way in my neighborhood,
okay. And
no one plants trees in the right-of-way, so that was not an issue in my neighborhood anyway.
Well, Dave, not everybody can afford to live in your neighborhood. Okay?
No, it's a newer neighborhood,
so they buried
the utilities.
I
know what you're saying. There are plenty more expensive neighborhoods around here, trust me.
Invite me out. You say it's a new neighborhood. I don't even know where it is, whatever the city it's in.
Well, like Jordan, I'll keep it as an undisclosed location.
I don't know if we're living in this country anymore. I don't know where you are. Matter of fact, I might have to run you by our next guest, through our next guest, just to make sure you're okay.
Good luck with
that. Thank you, Dave. James Olson is our next guest. He's a professor of the practice at the Bush School of Government of Texas A&M University. Now, listen to this. He is a former chief of counterintelligence at the CIA with 31 years of experience doing espionage and covert action work undercover for the CIA. So, like, you see Homeland and you see, I don't know if this was so much in The Americans or not, where you saw the CIA, but this guy's a real deal. He's been there and done that for a long time. He's the author of To Catch a Spy, The Art of Counterintelligence, which is an excellent read, and I don't need to sell books for James Olson, but I'm telling you, if you're looking for a book to give somebody that is a fascinating read for the holidays, I can't suggest anything more than this. It's called To Catch a Spy, The Art of Counterintelligence, and with that, we welcome in James Olson. Hey, James, how are you?
Good morning, Tommy. Nice to talk to you.
I appreciate your time. I really do. Let's talk about this Navy nuclear engineer. First thing that stuck out to me was that you could sell your country out for $100,000, really? Is in terms of espionage, and is it relatively low dollar crime? Are people relatively willing, rather, to sell their country out for a relatively low amount of money like that?
Not usually, but greed is the number one motivation for spies like this. I think they planned out a bigger payday later on. I think they were expecting that once they got the relationship going, that they would be able to demand more and more money. Clearly, money was the motivation for these two.
Let's go back and take a step back, I guess, if we will, sir, and maybe you can educate the audience as to what exactly, who did what, and what was the damage?
In this case, we think that the Navy nuclear engineer and his wife, they were co-conspirators, decided to cash in on his access to information on U.S. nuclear submarines. And what they did was to send a package of classified documents to an unspecified third country with the offer of providing more in the future in return for money. And apparently these documents were quite sensitive, would be very damaging if they got into the wrong hands. That unspecified country, thank goodness, went to the FBI attaché in that country and explained what had happened, provided all the information. And the FBI, and I'm very, very impressed by what they did in this case, decided to run it back against the two people who were offering their services. Mm-hmm. So what they did was pose as a member of that country, as an intelligence officer from that country, made the contact and solicited more information. They did a couple clandestine acts with them. They really set the hook in them. Once they had incontrovertible evidence of espionage, they arrested them. One of the really neat things about this case, I believe, was that this unspecified third country, which clearly is a friend of the United States, I would hope so anyway, mm-hmm. had to be involved in sending a signal to these two people. They were a little bit wary. They didn't know if this was real or not. They were afraid that they might be being set up. So they asked that that country's embassy in the United States in Washington, D.C., fly a certain flag from the top of their embassy building. And this country agreed. And they showed the signal, and these people were reassured. They continued on with this ruse that the FBI was running. And we've got them. We've got them cold.
Do you have any idea, and I guess a lot of that is classified, how much damage was done, or what do you think?
I don't think any damage was done because this country is a friend, we believe.
Oh, that's right. What am I thinking of? Yeah, that's right.
It wouldn't have
yes.
cooperated, so this material never got into the wrong hands, as far as we can tell.
In the game of spy and counter-spy in my head, James, I kind of got myself confused there, which is good. I didn't do it for a living. You're talking about the raising of the flag, and that brings us to tradecraft, I guess. What was some of the techniques involved here? What were some of the techniques, and something about a peanut butter sandwich, and what exactly was passed?
Well, one of the standard techniques in our business of espionage is what we call a dead drop. And a dead drop is nothing more than a hiding place where either the agent or the intelligence officer, we call a case officer, can leave a package for the other. And if it's from the intelligence officer to the agent, it might be money, it might be requirements, it might be a new camera, it might be a new SW carbon, secret writing carbon. It could be anything that the agent needs to carry out his or her clandestine work. If it's from the agent to the intelligence officer, it probably would be documents, it might be film, it might be a disc, anything that is going to be passed to the intelligence service. And that was what happened here. The FBI, posing as that intelligence service from the other country, set up a dead drop, and they were responding, and they concealed some film strips or disc or something inside a peanut butter sandwich, excuse me. And that's what they passed as a concealment at the dead drop. Pretty clever, not too bad. I think that they were getting into the spirit of the thing, mm-hmm. but it was all, of course, uncovered by the FBI.
You've done this for your life's work. Is there a point where you've seen life imitate art as opposed to the other way around?
Well, I think so. We all watch the movies and we read the books. And sometimes I think that we have had ideas that have come from outside that we incorporate into our business. It works in the other direction as well. And I think some of the fictional portrayals, some of the books, some of the TV shows have actually been a pretty good, accurate depiction of what we do in the spy world. You mentioned the Americans. I think that was excellent. And there have been others that have been pretty good. There's a lot of junk out there also, things that we don't recognize as any semblance to reality at all. But there have been a few good things from time to time.
Do any of them come to the top of your mind, James? Because I'd love to see them if I haven't already.
Yeah. There's a new movie out called The Courier, and that's based on the Oleg Penkovsky and Greville Wynne case. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very gripping portrayal of this actual operation where we had recruited a Russian, Oleg Penkovsky, to provide intelligence to us. He did a really good job, and Greville Wynne was the courier. So I like that movie a lot, and I would recommend it to your listeners. The Bridge of Spies is a little bit older, but that also is a good spy movie. I would say that that's worth watching. Argo Going Back, which won the Academy Award, is excellent. It was the story of how the CIA got some of its people out of Iran after the hostage capture in 1979. So there are a few things out there, but I'm really recommending above all the TV series, The Americans, which you mentioned, which I'm glad you enjoyed it. I did too, and I recommend it to my students.
It's about time to rewatch it, as a matter of fact. We're going to take a break. We come back, we'll talk about some that dangle, for example, and some different types of tradecraft. And a big question I have is, you know, occasionally you feel pretty good about yourself because you think you did something. But then as you go to bed that night, you think, oh, wait a minute, what about all the other things I could have done and didn't, or things I didn't catch? And as it relates to this, I'd just like to know how much of a handle you think we have on others passing secrets because they're attempting to sell out their country. We caught this guy and his wife, but are we missing some? It's 9:20 on this Thursday morning, October 14th, day 46 of the Ida recovery. Spending a fascinating hour with James Olson, professor of practice at the Bush School of Government of Texas A&M University, former chief of, congratulations, James, on beating Alabama, as a matter of fact. I wanted to tell you that. Former chief of counterintelligence at the CIA with 31 years of experience doing espionage and covert action work undercover for the CIA, and author of an excellent book, To Catch a Spy, The Art of Counterintelligence. If you have any questions, you can text them in to 504-260-1870. And I'll try to get them answered for you. I'm Tommy Tucker. We'll be right back here on WWL. It is 9:26 now on this Thursday morning, October 14th. Hang on. Fall weather's coming. It's not going to be today and it's not going to be tomorrow. But Friday night, Saturday morning, you're going to notice a difference. Saturday, breezy, cooler, highs of only 74. And the same thing on Sunday, and overnight temperatures Saturday, 48 North Shore, 58 South Shore. So I don't know about indoors, but you might be able to get a nice fire going around a fire pit outside and have a good time. We're talking with James Olson, professor of practice at the Bush School of Government of Texas A&M University, former chief of counterintelligence at the CIA, with 31 years of experience doing espionage and covert action work undercover for the CIA, and author of To Catch a Spy, The Art of Counterintelligence. And we're talking about the Navy nuclear engineer who tried to sell secrets to another country. Thankfully, the country, the intermediary that he went to, was a friend of the United States and ratted him out. So then they built up, I guess, an airtight case, and they got him cold. James, is that pretty accurate?
They're going to spend a lot of time in prison, no question about it, and they deserve it. They betrayed our country, or tried to.
This is not, you know, so many times people politically, wrongly, I think, bandy about the word treason, but this really is treason, is it not? Or at least attempted treason?
No question about it. They betrayed our country. They betrayed our secrets. They betrayed everybody they worked with. And in extreme cases, some of which I was involved in, they actually identify other countries' spies, for example, Russians or Chinese who were working with us. And those people, of course, are arrested and executed. So that's really despicable. They're not only traitors, but they're murderers.
So how does somebody get access to that information and turn bad? Are they recruited? What is the normal process on something like that, if there is a normal process?
Well, there are two ways that a person can become a spy. Let me talk about Americans who go bad. They either can volunteer their services, making contact with a foreign intelligence service, or they can be recruited. And all intelligence services have people out there who are looking for Americans who might be susceptible to some kind of an approach. And so they would try to establish a relationship with them. They'd get to know them. They would size them up. They would see whether or not they can cut corners here and there, whether or not they're out for money. Whatever their vulnerability is, whatever their weaknesses are, they will prey on that. Sometimes, often, it is money. Sometimes it can be other things. It can be sex. It can be coercion. It can be some other kind of favor that they can offer in return for the treason. And these are people who work in the government, or they work in high-tech companies that have government contracts. They have something that the other services want, and they realize that they can make a lot of money by selling it. And so they often do that because they simply want to have a big payday, and they can cash in a lot of money. Some of them make hundreds of thousands of dollars or more.
So Fox News reporting, and I'm not trying to create a tempest or anything, but that they were supported Black Lives Matter, some other resistance movements. They were very anti-Trump. I'm not saying that anybody that is involved with those organizations is selling out the country. But I guess what I'm asking, James, is if you have a strong social media presence and you express a lot of dissatisfaction with your country, does that kind of make you a target? If you're in one of those positions that the enemy thinks, you know what, maybe we got a little in here.
Well, I think that's a good point, because we know that the foreign intelligence services, and specifically the Russians and the Chinese, mine the social media sites. They are looking for Americans who are disgruntled, who are expressing anti-American views, expressing extreme views of any kind. One of their favorite techniques is to go into LinkedIn, where former military officers, former government officials of all kinds are seeking new employment, and they're listing their resumes, they're listing their clearances they had, they're listing some of the projects they were involved in. That's like a candy store for a foreign intelligence service. Mm-hmm. The Chinese are particularly good at it. And if they see someone who had access to classified information and who wants to go out on the market again, new employment, they contact that person under some kind of pretext. They will pose as a talent hunter or as a think tank, an institute, or a university. They will try to lure that person over to China or to Russia for interviews, for a guest lecture. They pay well, and they try to ensnare that person gradually into giving up the classified information. It is a technique that we have seen over and over again, and unfortunately it works. The sad reality is that too many Americans can be bought. Too many Americans are willing to betray our country for money.
In terms of the countermeasures that the United States employs to keep this from happening, that's a very proactive approach, I would presume?
I would hope so. I have some concerns about the state of U.S. counterintelligence. I think we're being overwhelmed, particularly by the Chinese. The Chinese espionage services are mounting a massive and pervasive attack on American secrets, American technology, American databases, industrial processes, agricultural technology, medical technology. They're appetites are voracious, and they're very, very good at it, and they're throwing unprecedented resources at us. I don't think that we have been up to the task. I think we need to do a much better job. We need more counterintelligence resources. We need a better awareness. I think most Americans aren't even conscious of the fact that this is going on, and we need to wake up. We need to do a much better job of stopping what they're doing, particularly China. I don't know of a single counterintelligence expert in the United States who will say anything other than that China is the number one threat, and we've got to do a lot better job of stopping that.
So is it about willpower? Is it about money? Why aren't we?
I think it's just a lack of priority. I think we've got other things. We have other calls on our resources. Counterterrorism, nonproliferation, organized crime, counter-narcotics, those are all valid places to put our resources. But too often, in my experiences, that has been at the cost of counterintelligence. Our bench is very weak. We don't have a real cadre we've developed of counterintelligence experts. We're trying to correct that. I'm doing my part at the Bush School because I teach counterintelligence here and working hard to prepare young men and women for careers in counterintelligence. But we need a lot of reinforcements. And we need also a government that speaks up more and makes certain that when we catch China or we catch a Russia in the act, that there are serious consequences. Too often it's a slap on the wrist, and that's not good enough.
Take a quick break. We'll pick it up here. We come back. I do want to talk about, pardon me, some of the tradecraft involved and some of your stories, because I know you've been on with us before, but a lot of people have not heard some of them. And I think it's fascinating just the life that you've led. And before we do go to the break, Professor, have you noticed a lot of the younger people wanting to get involved in this, the people that you teach?
Absolutely. We have a long list of applicants trying to get into our program. And that's very heartening to see that so many young people want to serve our country in various ways, but including in the intelligence community and in my area, particularly in spy catching.
All right, a quick break, 9:35. Tommy Tucker, more when we come back. We're talking to James Olson. He was a former chief of counterintelligence at the CIA, 31 years of experience doing espionage and covert action work. He's going to tell us a story for the CIA. He's going to tell us a story when we come back that will raise the hairs on the back of your neck because it involved his family. And it's hard to believe that you go to a country and engage in this spy craft and you got your family with you, but it does happen, and that's part of it. I guess it goes to credibility. 9:35, 25 before 10. Traffic now on WWL. 9:41, 19 before 10. Newell Norman's going to be live out at the brand new People's Health thing that's set up, a center. I shouldn't call it a thing. It's a Medicare center, 3017 Vets near Causeway, right next to Party City. Tomorrow, open enrollment begins. So People's Health will have a team of experts on site to answer your questions and guide you through the process. And you can meet Newell Norman and say hi to him. And People's Health, we found out earlier today, has a 5-star rating, and that's hard to get. We're talking to James Olson about spying and espionage. He's a professor of practice at the Bush School of Government of Texas A&M University, former chief of counterintelligence at the CIA with 31 years of experience doing espionage and covert action work undercover for the CIA. And he wrote a book that is just magnificent, To Catch a Spy, The Art of Counterintelligence. And if you're doing some Christmas shopping, I don't know of anybody that wouldn't like to read this book. We talked about the Navy nuclear engineer that was arrested trying to sell secrets. Fortunately, no damage was done because he reached out to a third country that was friendly to the United States. But James, if you would, tell us some of the things that happened to you when you were undercover, if you can. I can't imagine how you maintain your composure in one of these situations. How do you do that when you know everything that's on the line, you're afraid you're going to be discovered? Is that part of the training?
Well, it certainly is. So we are trained to deal with the stress of a undercover lifestyle. It's very important that your spouse be fully on board and is willing to live that kind of life, and particularly if you're going to be raising children outside the country. It's very demanding, but you are very motivated to do it because you believe in the country. You are out there protecting American people. You're collecting intelligence that goes to our policymakers. It's a very rewarding career. I would do it all over again if I could. But you're right. It does have some downside, and one of them is risk. It's a dangerous profession. You are undercover. What you are doing in that foreign country is illegal. Espionage is a crime in every country. In some, the penalty can be as severe as execution. So you always know that you can't make a mistake. It's your margin for error is close to zero. You are very protective of your cover. You live your cover very, very closely so that no one suspects that you are actually leading a double life. And in addition to your day job, whatever your cover is, that could be as a business person or as a student if you're young enough, a retiree, could be as some kind of researcher, it could be even as a diplomat. You have a cover and you live that life, and that's all the outside world ever sees. My parents did not know that I was in the CIA. My wife's parents didn't know. Our children didn't know. So we were very, very careful about protecting the cover, because our effectiveness as spies depends on the integrity of our cover, and also our safety depends on the integrity of our cover, because not only are we subject to arrest and imprisonment if we get caught and don't have diplomatic immunity, but there are some really bad actors out there who would wish us harm. And there were some instances in our career where we faced that kind of risk.
At one point, you realized that your family was in jeopardy, did you not?
I did, and that was a very difficult time for us, because when Meredith and I were overseas in a certain country, we were doing some work against some terrorist groups. And we don't know how, but somehow these terrorist groups found out that the CIA was behind their problem, that I, Jim Olson, was a CIA officer managing those operations against them. So what they did was to send me a letter. And very ominously, they mailed it to our home address in that country. They wanted us to know that they knew where we lived. And that was a little bit scary. And I'll never forget that letter. I've kept it all these years. It started out, "Dear Infidel Dog." Now, you kind of know right off that's not going to be a friendly letter, right?
And they're not inviting you to a party at that point, right?
No, that's right. And it was a death threat. It was a serious death threat against me by name, against my wife Meredith by name, and against each of our three children by name. And the CIA actually offered to pull us out of the country because of the death threat to the children. It was really my wife, who's a remarkable woman, who said no. She said, "We've been sent here with a mission to perform. We're not going to be chased away by an ugly letter from some terrorists." So we, at that point, brought our children into the picture so that they could be alert. We put a lot of precautions on the children that they weren't aware of. We eventually got those terrorists, which made us all feel a lot better. And that's just the way we lived. We're constantly facing threats like that. But it was just part of the job, and we recognized that.
You know, I would think, depending on what country you're in, drinking would be a part, you know, and engaging in some social drinking, alcohol, et cetera. How do you keep that from compromising your judgment at all? Is there a way around that, Jim?
Well, we're trained, you know. Alcohol is a part of our career path. We are expected to wine and dine. We're expected to be at cocktail parties. We're expected to entertain our foreign targets and liaison partners. So we have to be able to do a good job and keep our cool, keep our faculties intact, even though we are out there drinking it up with the best of them. We do have some training in that regard. Some of us jokingly called the training the course on strategic drinking. And I remember we were taught how to feign drinking, but not actually consume alcohol. But one of the cardinal rules, which I'll never forget, was you should never forget you can never out-vodka a Russian. So we never tried to do that.
But just being a human being, your judgment gets compromised. So the secret is, or the trick is, not to ever get to that point where your judgment is compromised, correct?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You have to keep your cool. You have to keep your faculties. You have to make certain that you're not impaired at all. And that is something that we work on and are trained to do.
Let me ask you about the farm. Camp Peary, I think, is the name of it. What kind of education do people get there, if you can, without divulging any secrets? What kind of curriculum is it? What is somebody expecting, or what can somebody expect if they decide that the CIA is for them? And do they spend a set amount of period at the set amount of time at the farm?
Right. You know, we call the farm our training center, and it is undercover. And it's a beautiful setting. We all loved our time at the farm. And when you join the CIA, if you're on the operational side, you're going to spend a lot of time down at the farm in training. And the training is world class. It's fantastic. I don't think anybody does it better. And obviously, you're going to learn the art of spying. You're going to learn the tradecraft. You're going to learn clandestine photography, surveillance. You're also going to learn some paramilitary skills, things like weapons and explosives. A lot of people go through a parachute jumping training. All the skills that you're going to need to be an effective spy, depending on which country you're being assigned to. The farm is something that's a big part of our careers. Even after our initial training, it's likely we'll go down to the farm periodically for refresher training or for specialized training in some new field that we're going to be going into.
Let me run a couple of words by you. Dangle. What is a dangle?
I love dangles, as long as we're doing them against our adversaries and not vice versa. A dangle is the front end of a double agent operation. Let me tell you how it might work. We know, for example, that the Chinese are trying to steal technology on aircraft. And so we maybe go out and find an aircraft engineer. And we talk to that engineer. We size that person up. Is this person a good candidate to be a dangle, to be a double? And if so, we train that person. And then we float that person past Chinese intelligence. That person may go and volunteer his or her services, but ideally we will let them think that they started the operation. So we're dangling that person to Chinese intelligence, for example, hoping that they will grab it, that they will try to recruit this person. And then with our coaching, we let that happen. We let them recruit that person and run that person as a spy. We have to provide feed material that we give them willingly, because that's why they're running this operation. They want to get intelligence. But in the process, we are learning all about their personnel, who they are, where they operate, their MO, their requirements. We take their money. It's a win. I love double agent operations, and for that reason, I love dangles, and I wish we had more of them.
Real quick, dry clean. It says actions agents take to determine if they're under surveillance. How would you do something like that? How would you go about that, Jim?
When you're working overseas, of course, you've got to make certain that what you're doing is not being observed by surveillance. And when Meredith and I served in Moscow, for example, we were under 24-hour surveillance by the KGB. And they're good. They take great pride in their work. But we've got to be better. We've got to beat them. And so we have techniques for evading surveillance, but also we have, at the front end, techniques for determining whether we are under surveillance or not. Usually that consists of launching into a pattern of activities that are normal, part of your everyday pattern, stopping at the dry cleaners, stopping at the post office, buying a newspaper, stopping in a coffee shop. And while you're doing that, you're constantly using your skills to determine whether or not you're under surveillance. And if you don't see surveillance, then you push it. You become increasingly provocative, try to flush them out if they're there. And only after an extended period, it could be a matter of 2, 3, 4 hours, can you say categorically, I am not under surveillance. We call that in our parlance getting black. I am black. And black is beautiful, because you then know that you're free of surveillance and you are free to go out and do whatever your operational act is.
James, thank you. Thank you, wife. All of the people that are involved in this in terms of service of the country, I will never have any idea, I guess, of how involved it is. But I love talking to you. It's a fascinating book, To Catch a Spy, The Art of Counterintelligence, and I highly recommend it. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Have a good day.
Yes, sir. Thank you. You too.
James Olson, I didn't want to say while he was with us, but that man's got a set on him, huh? 9:54 coming back, WWL.
Oh, O'Reilly.
For a
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Now, with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Day, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.